The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. 6 wins on the bounce for Liverpool as they see off Chelsea at the Bridge, while Man City whacked 5 past Watford in the first 18 minutes and had 3 more just for fun. Leicester a third thanks to James Maddison and half a millimetre of Heung-min Son's shoulder, while Arsenal come back with 10 men to beat Villa at the Emirates. And is Phil Jones right? Will Ole get the boot just after we finish recording? In Spain, Barcelona lose as Bilbao go top. We'll round up the rest of Europe. We'll judge the Puskas goal of the season award before the judges do tonight. Answer your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nick Ames. Hello.
Hello.
First appearance of the season.
Yep, I'm fresh. I'm primed. I've been training hard for the last month and a half.
Okay. Are you feeling under pressure to deliver, or do you feel that the quality of the squad around you means you can just ease into it seamlessly?
Yeah, I feel like someone coming back to the club where he began his career. And, you know, the personnel may change, but the fittings are the same.
Nicky Bandini, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Excellent news. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Right. Chelsea 1, Liverpool 2. Liverpool are now on 15 consecutive wins in the Premier League. The record is held by Man City for an 18-game winning streak they had at the end of 2017. Frank Lampard said Chelsea didn't deserve to lose. Is he right, Nicky Bandini?
Yes, I think he probably is right. But, I mean, deserves a really sort of hard word to use, isn't it? I felt like if you were assessing, I guess, between the sort of the various little moments that went against them, the Azpilicueta goal that was rightly disallowed, but nevertheless was a pretty fractional decision, and the way Chelsea ended the game when it really did feel like Liverpool had wilted a little bit by the end of the game and the chances they could have taken in those last moments. It felt like Chelsea maybe, I certainly think Liverpool couldn't have felt hard done by if it had been a point split, put it that way. Having said that, Liverpool remain magnificent, and Chelsea were also in certain moments slightly authors of their own demise. I mean, there's a lot of talk on the Sky coverage about how they defended that free kick and whether or not they should have been more cognizant you're not going to get that ball up and over the wall, so could you do more to stop
it? It looked simple, didn't it? And maybe, yeah, that's the beauty of it.
Well, exactly, and I think that's, you know, that speaks a lot to Liverpool's execution as well, and I think that's something that comes out. You think about that corner routine in the Champions League last season as well, how sort of neat they are in these little moments, in these set pieces that they've clearly practiced. They're not just sort of winging it. It's not Thierry Henry and Robert Pires deciding to pass the penalty. It's something that's so sort of precision tuned that they can do it and make it happen very quickly and give you a little time to defend as well. But yes, to answer your initial question, I think Chelsea played well enough in the overall, despite some lesser moments during the game, that they probably could have felt like they merited a point.
Barney Ronay writing in the paper saying, what is offside actually for? Firstly, to stop the game from losing its shape, dissolving into a cross between Aussie rules and mass goal hanging. And secondly, in its finer margins, to stop players cheating by pushing this enforced line and gaining an advantage. In this case, there was no advantage to Mount in having a toe arguably beyond the line of a player 20 yards away. It didn't cause the game to lose its shape. It was offside because a man with a pen drew a pointlessly certain line. And as he said, a middle-aged man with a pen is not the Large Hadron Collider. Barry?
I agree with Barney, but people who say, you know, the offside police, the fun police, they are also correct.
Brian says, with VAR causing goals to be ruled out, is it time for the people who update the scores on the Vidi printer to hang fire before putting up a goal? Or is that quite fun on Soccer Saturday when a goal comes up and then it goes away again, the score correction? I mean, it really has added to the work of the Vidi printer man, hasn't it?
Yeah, I would rather, if it was the old Vidi printer where it comes out a letter at a time, and then just starting to watch the letters retreat back off the screen. Yeah, so you'd have Chelsea 1-1 Liverpool, and then that would be quite fun. It's not the same with the more high tech Vidi printer.
Do you think Chelsea should have done better with Firmino's header as well? He seemed to be in an awful amount of space, and he's a wonderful footballer, and he clearly creates space for himself. But he's, you know, he's not the tallest man in the world.
I think this is definitely one of the narratives of this weekend and of the season so far, is it's not just the VAR decisions, it's what happens in the minutes after the VAR decisions. And it felt to me very much here, and very much the same with Tottenham after their goal was disallowed, like Chelsea were in this moment of inattentiveness, in this moment of sort of, it's not as, you know, it's not clear cut, it's not like everyone's standing there waving their arms around, but there's just a moment of thinking about injustice or sense of frustration. And I think that takes away from teams, and I think that as long as this is the way we're officiating the game, I think that players are going to have to work on managing their emotional reaction to these moments.
Do you think the right way to celebrate would be to score and everyone just go like this? All the players put their hands up. Someone will do it, won't they? The team will put their hands up.
Barney has basically addressed that in his match report too. He said that's coming. A time when teams will score and they won't celebrate, and it'll be, you know, calm down, lads, calm down. This might be chalked off.
Ronaldo sort of jokingly did it after a goal for Juventus, not this weekend, but the previous round of games. He scored and then sort of ran off doing the VAR motion and sort of doing a calm down gesture while grinning, because he knew, I think, that this one wasn't going to get. But yeah.
I wonder actually whether, because a lot of these decisions are taking 1 minute, 2 minutes to be made, could there not be a time limit on the amount of time it takes to make a VAR decision? Like, I mean, that's entirely imperfect, but let's say, for example, if you cannot come to a conclusion within 1 minute, then it's as you were. I mean,
actually, now you think about it, just imagine the goal goes in and then suddenly the countdown clock starts.
Ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding.
And they're just waiting there going, goal. I'm in. And N'Golo Kante started after a month out. Has his role changed massively since last season? It's, you know, Jorginho's still there. And obviously this was the only thing you were allowed to talk about last season. But it doesn't seem to change. I mean, he's such a great player. It was such a wonderful goal. But is he doing something different?
I don't think so. He's certainly got that license to bomb on a little bit, and doesn't always finish, I think, in the way that he did on Sunday. That was an absolutely fantastic goal. But I think, you know, he can eat up space so well. He can get into those areas in front of defences. It's useful to unleash him in that way. I was quite impressed yesterday that, I mean, okay, there was maybe a bit of a feeling of injustice among the Chelsea crowd and that kind of thing, but they got such a warm reception at the end, virtually cheered from the pitch. And I think there's an acknowledgement at that club of what Frank Lampard is doing with the youngsters, that they will have off days and off moments, like even switching off and showing a bit of inexperience maybe for that Firmino goal. And it's almost like Frank's got a bit of a free pass there, you know, and can try things, and they can go wrong, and they can have days where better teams expose them. Maybe they'll fall out of the top four or top six, I don't know. But there seems to be a sort of feel-good factor around everything that's going on there right now, even when it's going wrong.
Here's a question from Alan, which I think, Nicky, will conflict you in many ways. So Emmanuel Petit, who presumably you love as an Arsenal fan, stated on French TV post-match, can someone please explain to me what Jorginho does? I don't know why he gets a game. Presumably also, you know, you represent Jorginho in this area.
I don't actually represent all Italian players. if I did, I'd probably be a lot richer, and that'd be great. He hasn't still, under Lampard, from what I've seen, really made this midfield his own in the same way that he did that Napoli midfield. And what's interesting now is you look at the Napoli midfield and it's evolved so far beyond him. But in that year with Sarri, when they did get 91 points, he was the heart of everything. And he, what does he do? I mean, he's an excellent distributor. I think that, you know, he still can play the same passes, but it's never felt like he has, I don't know, ownership of that space. Like, he has clarity in his role, perhaps, that he had when he was at Napoli. So I think there is, perhaps even when Nick was talking a second ago about, is Kante playing in the same way or not? I think there's still, and perhaps even more so from the fact that you've now got a new manager, but still ostensibly playing in the same formation, a 4-3-3, there is still not a sense that, that he owns it, that all play is going to start with him. Because really that's what he was. I mean, at Napoli, the simplest analogy for it is the obvious one, which is the American football quarterback. You know, he was there. He was making the plays in the middle of the pitch. He was touching the ball more than anybody else. He was he was the hub from which everything started.
Could it be as simple as the fact that you just have slightly less time on the ball in the Premier League? Or is that a cliche that I'm guilty of
using? No, I mean, I think it's true. I think in general it's true. And I think certainly if you look at the performances of Italian teams in the Champions League this last week, that the two greatest disappointments were from two teams that were very aggressively pressed, Atalanta and Inter, and didn't handle it well. Now, it's certainly an oversimplification to pretend that never happens in Serie A, because it does happen very much so with certain teams. But it probably does happen less. And I think perhaps the players around him haven't protected him in quite the same way. I think at Napoli, he really did have, especially that season in Alan, someone who was almost like his bodyguard, who was really specifically looking after him and doing that work for him. And perhaps Kante has been...
Kante's too small for a bodyguard, isn't he?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's about physical size. Alan's not huge, but it's about sort of the free roaming that Kante does, perhaps that takes away from having someone specifically doing that work for you. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to, because I'm Italian, sit here and say that Jorginho has been brilliant when he hasn't been. I don't think he's found his place at Chelsea, and, you know, that actually knocks on for Italy when he's not playing great for Chelsea. It's not the best for the Italian national team either.
Chelsea host Grimsby in the League Cup. Liverpool go to MK Dons. All right, then, to the King Power. Leicester 2, Spurs 1. Leicester, Nick, have a really, you know, they've got such a great... They maybe don't have the depth of these sides, but they're into third now. James Maddison's winner was brilliant. He had a brilliant game as well, didn't he?
He did, and he's one of those players who you love to watch because he's always got his head up and he's always thinking about what his next move and my next move but one is going to be. And those players are pretty much my favourite ones to watch, I think. And he's also not afraid to have a go, and he's actually one of the best long-range shooters, I think, in the league, as we saw with that winning goal, which arrowed into the bottom corner. And I think he's playing, you know, in a structure. He's not just a free spirit. He works to the instructions that Rodgers gives, and Rodgers likes his teams to play in quite a structured passing way. I think what Brendan Rodgers has done there is absolutely fantastic. He's made good signings. He's not ripped things to shreds. He knew there was a good basis and nucleus of players there. In the space of 7 or 8 months since February, he's turned them from a team that was capable of moments but didn't really have a clear identity, certainly did not play fast, fluid, dynamic attacking football, into one that is a genuine contender now to threaten the established order of that top six. And I can see them staying up there. I think they are a better side than Manchester United. I think they are more coherent side than Arsenal, which we will definitely come to later. I think at the moment they're a more stable side than Tottenham. And as I say, he's got the balance right at the moment between having this structure and order and quite methodical build-up, but then having these players like Maddison who can provide moments.
Fun within a structure, the Brendan Rodgers party, isn't it? Okay, then, well, we've done some football. We don't need to spend hours on the fact that Sergio Rio's goal should have stood, right? Or am I? I don't know. Maybe I'm biased. This just doesn't. It's so tight and it's so ridiculous how long it takes. And I don't know if we can say anything new or have we covered it all.
Well, I think we've sort of covered it already. Technically, by the application of the law, however you feel about it, you know, I'm still not convinced they can be certain when exactly the ball is passed. He was offside. I don't like it, but that's the way it is. I am convinced the only solution to the VAR issue that will possibly appease everyone, because it's not going to go away, is to have an appeals decision like cricket, two per game, per, you know, manager, captain, doing between them. Get one wrong, you lose it, and that is the only sort of reasonably workable solution I can see. Would Brendan Rodgers have, you know, called for a review on that Aurier goal? I very much doubt so.
Because they're losing, because if you've got the review and you're 1-0 down, you've conceded a second goal, you go, well, all right, then do it, just because It's, you know, that happens in cricket sometimes.
It does happen in cricket, but I think it will happen more. I think if you did have that in football, I think it would happen every single goal, because a goal is such a massive moment. And there are,
but you only have two reviews.
But how many goals happen in a game? Normally, you're not going to unlikely can see more than two, so you just do it every single goal.
It would risk breaking the game up even more, especially at key moments. You know, if it was boiling down to an exciting last minute winner or something like that, you think, well, what the hell? I'll use my review, even if it's unlikely to come off.
And actually, we do have to remember that if VAR didn't exist, Leicester would have taken the lead from a goal that was definitely offside, right? And so, yeah. Because Perez was offside, and we'd be complaining about that.
I think we are so far into the almost the conceptual reads with this when the pass is played conversation, because Jonathan Wilson's talked about it on this podcast before. Of course, there's the frame rate of cameras and whether or not they can keep up with the millimetres we're talking about here. But there's also, like, when is the pass played? Is it the moment when the foot comes back? Is it the moment when the foot first touches the ball to play that pass? Is it the moment when there's a tiny bit of separation between the ball and the foot? Like, the frames are, like, it's ridiculous. And I think that clearly is ridiculous. I also don't have an easy answer for it, because you have to draw a line somewhere, right? And if we could say, oh, maybe we should not be talking about, is it any part of the body that can score, or should there be daylight? But even then, you'd still be getting into the same conversation about where are the millimetres, where are the... So this is an inherent flaw with the technology. If you're going to use technology to judge it, you're going to have to put a line somewhere. And the laws of football were not written in a time when we had these rules.
Yeah. So offside was introduced, you know, so Victorian gentlemen wouldn't goal hang. You know, this is not what it was, what offside is supposed to be about.
I mean, the solution is just not to have the technology, and to accept that sometimes stuff marginally goes in your favour and marginally doesn't, which is, you know, how people who like football, I think, should.
Yeah, but now everyone can see on Twitter in the ground that it's a mistake.
And the problem is this, I mean, you know, Gary Neville tweeted about it, saying, for years everyone has moaned saying they want an objective decision. Now we have an objective decision. You might not like it, but it's objective. I can see all sides of this. And I think it's true that if we weren't arguing, I think this particular case, if there wasn't VAR, we would not be talking about it. But for instance, the Mount decision, if it had been given, I think that was visible enough that people might be arguing about it if it hadn't been VAR'd. So
I like the, what would
way.
We have been arguing
yeah,
about
well,
without
exactly,
VAR?
Yeah.
Hey, Harry Kane's goal was a ludicrous finish, wasn't it, Baz?
Yeah. I actually think that should be a contender for goal of the month, goal of the season, because the way he had to improvise, had lost his balance, been shoved by Soyuncu, and the way he sort of had the mental wherewithal to scrabble back, hook the ball over the keeper into the back of the net, it's fantastic.
And that is what we should be talking about here, rather than all this technology. VAR, was he a millimetre off thing? And that's the shame of it, really. It should be the second thing we're talking about.
But you brought it up again, Nick.
Well, I'm sad we haven't spoken more about Maddison, because Nick got to say how much you love watching him. I think Maddison's just brilliant. Such fast feet. Even before his goal. And by the way, you were saying about his long-range shooting, which I think your point is still basically right, but I've got a feeling on Match of the Day they said he'd taken the most shots in the league without scoring before that goal. So,
ouch.
I think that just before...
Well, it proves he does have a go, right?
He works for goalkeeper.
But yeah, I just think, yeah, it's the speed of his feet. When you watch him go, you think, how is he moving that quickly and keeping the ball under control and doing all of that? So that just, yeah, was the highlight of the game for me. But on the Kane goal, I also really enjoyed Schmeichel's reaction to it, because you saw him kicking the ball into the net afterwards, and they had the camera behind the goal. And it's that thing of, I don't know, anyone who's played football has had that experience of, like, you really thought you had the situation under control because you've seen him go over and you think it's fine, and then it isn't, and it's just, you realise that you were complacent in that moment, that you didn't. Yeah, he just had that real vibe of genuinely mad at himself that I enjoyed.
So Spurs' record now, what, played 6, won 2, drawn 2, lost 2. Same record as 5 other teams, Manchester United, Chelsea among them. You know, 3rd to 6th is going to be a real bum fight this year. But is the takeaway Spurs are just going through a tough time, or is it a huge blown-out crisis?
I think we're still in the context of it's early in the season, it's a tough away game. I did think Pochettino, by the way, was quite admirable in refusing to say anything about the VAR. He was just like, well, these things happen, because he's had some go his way as well. And I thought that was probably the right response to it.
I also think that, you know, we're talking about crises around Spurs, around United, around to a lesser extent maybe Arsenal, but as maybe as well as being some collective neurosis around the teams just below the top two, we're also finally seeing that moment now where the upper middle class, like Leicester, West Ham and teams like that, are finally benefiting from that extra push of TV money and the better players they can get in, and the fact that ultimately there's a certain level the top teams can get to without, you know, before the slightly inferior teams catch up with them.
Are they upper middle class or are they nouveau riche?
Arriviste.
Okay, right.
Like the lottery winners.
Are they doing it in a classy way or a gaudy way? You know, to challenge the aristocracy, the landed gentry.
I think they are catching up there, and I think that is as much an issue here as some sort of decline among the Arsenal's, United, Spurs. It's more of a plateauing and a natural catching up from the rest, because the resources now are so, when you get to a certain point, so similar.
Leicester go to Luton in the Carabao, Spurs go to Colchester. Another team in huge crisis, Manchester United. They lost 2-0 at West Ham. Nicholas says, will Ollie still be United's manager by the time the pod wraps up? He'll still be there this afternoon, won't he?
I would be very surprised if he wasn't, but I would be worried for his long-term future. I don't think his problems are necessarily his own fault. I think he's been overpromoted. This is possibly too big a job for him, but it's not been made easy for him by the fact that Manchester United don't have a coherent transfer policy in place, and that showed yesterday. They're light up front, they needed a striker, they're ponderous and slow in midfield. They had injuries yesterday, no Pogba, no Martial. No, Luke Shaw, Mason Greenwood was out as well. Tonsillitis, Marcus Rashford looks like he's going to be out for at least a couple of weeks with, I don't know, was it groin or hamstring he did. But they were diabolical yesterday.
Were they much worse than West Ham, or was it a game where nothing really happened?
I don't think West Ham had to do much to beat them. They took very little beating yesterday. West Ham didn't play particularly well. They were all right. They did enough. They were up against very little. Watching that Manchester United reminds me of watching them in the latter stages of Jose Mourinho's reign. There was no cutting edge whatsoever, no creativity, and they were so slow and ponderous on the ball. West Ham had to do sort of the bare minimum to beat them.
It's easy to be wise after the event, but I can't help wondering why they sold Romelu Lukaku. Like, I know he has his detractors, of which I'm not one, because I think he's got a phenomenal record, and I think he's a phenomenal player, actually.
I agree.
In that game, from the bits I saw, because I was preparing for the Arsenal match, there were moments where you're crying out just for someone to occupy the defence, even to win a dirty header or to put their elbow in someone or run that channel. And Marcus Rashford at the moment, having to play up there, it's an absolute waste of his talent. And I'm one of those who's always been a bit more on the fence about Rashford than some people have been. I think he's an very good talent, but probably not a world-class talent personally. But he was on a hiding to nothing out there yesterday.
Since Fergie left, right, Man United has spent £892 million. As producer Jonathan says, how on earth is their squad so bad? Like you said, no strikers on the bench. United's only shots on target came from McTominay, Matic and Maguire. You know, Jose on Sky was saying, look, I probably deserve to be sacked, but the sad reality is they are worse than before.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think what's sort of striking is when you look at even the starting 11, and you think, for all that money spent, where are the really sort of world-class players in this team? David De Gea? And what?
Pogba on his day.
Yeah, I mean, of course, he wasn't playing on the weekend. But yeah, when he's there, Pogba should be. But for the amount of money, it should be more than even if you give Pogba the full pass, it should be more than two players. It should be more than two players you're looking at and thinking, wow, that's a world-class international player.
Lars texted producer Jonathan yesterday arguing that West Ham currently have a better front four, Haller, Anderson, Yarmolenko and Fornals, than United, Rashford, James, Pereira, Mata.
There's absolutely no doubt about that. 100% true. Definitely. You're looking like...
Because it's just the thought that West Ham would have a better front four than United is bizarre to me.
Well, I think you're looking at a point of view just because they're at Manchester United. If they're at any other club, you wouldn't be particularly surprised.
You're probably right. I mean, in a converse way, I used to think that about players like Darren Fletcher, who I thought, I don't think he's that good, but I bet he would be good if he was somewhere else because Man United had so many good players. Do you know what I mean? And it's almost gone full circle. It's now got to a stage, right, where they're at... How long since Man United were good? You know, there are 10-year-olds who are Man United fans who have only experienced pain, pretty much, haven't they? Which is strange.
I think pain is still relative here.
Well, pain is relative, but in the sense, you know, the same way that, you know, there are teenagers who are Arsenal fans who can't remember winning the league, right? Mm. Or how long, I can't remember how long Arsenal were, but it's so long. How quickly it changes. You know, at some point you start feeling sorry for Man United fans. It'll be like the late 80s again when you think, God, it'd be really nice for them to have 20 years of dominance. Or is that just me? We're not at that stage yet.
Well, I can remember the last time Manchester United fans had to endure 10 years or more of pain, and that just makes me feel old, I suppose, because I've lived through the 20 years of dominance as well, and now the 10 years of pain, subsequent 10 years of pain. So, yeah, I'm really getting on.
Before we move on, we should say, look, Yarmolenko, was a you know, nice bit of work from him. It wasn't wonderful defending, and a lovely free kick from Aaron Cresswell.
Yeah, Cresswell coming back in, I think, after Masuaku was sent off last week. So, you know, that's quite a way to make an impact there, because I think he is their best left back. Yarmolenko has had such a long time out, so I think a word for the way he's come back in the team. He's looked very sharp the last couple of games especially, and if we're talking about someone who can shoot from range, I mean, that wasn't his goal yesterday, but he is one of the better long range shooters around. He's got a hammer of a left foot. And I think West Ham generally look good. They've got the best balance they've had yet under Pellegrini. The midfield, two at the base, you've got Rice and Noble. They complement each other very nicely. The attack is fluent. It can interplay. It's quite sharp. Haller up top. A couple of questions about his pace, I think, but he's got that presence that United definitely lacked the other day to lead that line. Back four looking okay. I think this is the best West Ham side I have seen in a very long time.
Okay, so where are they finishing, Nick? The best West Ham side?
Somewhere in the top 8.
Wow. So 8th. In the League Cup this week, West Ham go to Oxford United. Manchester United host Rochdale from just down the road. Let's see what happens if Rochdale win that one. All right, then Manchester City 8, Watford 0. 5-0 up after 18 minutes. It's just ludicrous, isn't it? Marcus says, how soon can Laporte get back to fitness? This crisis at Manchester City is unbearable. I mean, I lost count when I was noting down the goals. Producer Jonathan lost count when he wrote them in. He missed one. Is 8-0 an extraordinary scoreline? It is so rare, isn't it? Or is it extraordinary that no one is that surprised by the scoreline?
Well, it's an extraordinary scoreline because it happens so rarely. I think it was extraordinary in this case because they only got 8, because they could have got several more. And I know Nick is very upset that they didn't get 9, so I'm going to hand over to him. Nick, take the floor.
Yeah, no, when I was out and about on Saturday afternoon checking the scores, and while I wasn't being careful what I wished for as Ipswich went top of League One, winning it at Gillingham, I was keeping as keen an eye, I have to say, on events at the Etihad, because every time a team gets to 5 or 6 in a Premier League game, the WhatsApps go off and the Ipswich fans start absolutely nail-biting it, hoping that obviously the famous 9-0 from 94-95 can finally be exceeded. And it never is. And this time I felt there was a chance. Normally, going back to your earlier point, actually, Max, I think teams often get to 5 or 6. And I think they do ease up a bit. I think they do. Now, I don't necessarily think it's some sort of gentleman's code of conduct that you don't thrash a team. I think footballers and managers love to win. But I think you look at the games ahead, you manage your minutes, you make your subs, you wind down a bit because a game's won. But as soon as that 6th goal went in after half time, I thought, oh, they're still at this. They're still trying to do it. And then obviously later you get the 7th and the 8th. And for the last 6 minutes, the Ipswich supporting fraternity, I think, was just absolutely willing it. And I think, you know, by all accounts, there were a few more chances to add to that tally. Yes. But it hasn't happened. I think it never will happen.
So where were Ipswich? Were at Gillingham, weren't they?
We were.
Were the Ipswich fans at Gillingham? Do you think they were spending more time on social media thinking, oh, I hope City do it? Because I'm surprised you want to lose that badge of honour. When Cambridge, for a long time, had the record of the most consecutive league games without a victory, right? It's the chapter in Nick Hornby's book when he's studying in Cambridge, and they never win, and then you just eventually becomes this sort of masochistic thing that you want to go on forever and ever, and they finally beat Newcastle, you know, a Newcastle with Beardsley and Keegan, and they win 1-0 with a penalty. And then I think Derby County took that record when they had that terrible run in the Premier League, and I'm slightly sad that we don't have that badge of honour. But you would like Ipswich to not be the record defeat.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't go to bed at night worrying about it, but there are definitely times when I'll go on holiday somewhere a long way away, and you'll get chatting to someone who's a sort of, I would say, in the nicest way, casual Premier League fan. Oh, I support Ipswich. Oh, 9-0, 9-0. And you're like, can we talk about something else?
Otherwise, they'd have nothing to talk to you. Maybe stood in silence.
No, true. And so as a sort of...
It's a great icebreaker.
As a social lubricant, it serves a purpose. But can we just be done with it?
John Bruin on the live blog, have Watford given up completely? What do we say about Watford in this?
They almost equalised at 1-0.
They did, didn't they?
De La Feo went through on goal. Could have been a completely different game. Could have been 8-1.
De La Feo completed 13 passes in his 77 minutes. 8 were kickoffs.
That's astonishing.
It's a great stat, isn't it? And as someone tweeted brilliantly, they're approaching this clearly... Sanchez Flores has said, approach this like a cup final, with reference to the 6-0 defeat to City in the cup final.
There is obviously nothing to be embarrassed about, usually, by getting beaten by a team as good as Man City, but this was embarrassing for them because they just weren't trying. And
do you think they were? Because it's hard, right? City could have done this to a lot of teams, and it's, you get tired running after people.
But
right?
They weren't running after people. That's the whole point. It was a feeble effort. It's almost as if City scored within a minute and Watford just went, oh God, here we go again, and that was it.
And they weren't, I mean, some of the goals were blinding, and like Kevin De Bruyne, we have to give a word for him, because every ball he strikes is just brilliant.
That cross is sensational.
That cross is not defendable. The hit for the last goal was a lovely way to finish it off, and I don't think there's no better player in the league at the moment, and hopefully we'll get a full season out of him. But a few of those goals, it wasn't necessarily about Man City ripping them apart. The penalty, he's going away from goal, out of play. What is Ben Foster doing? The goal that Otamendi scored from memory, I think it's a flick across goal, and he puts it in. Maybe Bernardo Silva's first two, he's coming in and nodding it almost unmarked at the back stick, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
So it wasn't completely liquid football, you know.
True, and you've got a feel for Tom Cleverley, Mahrez free kick, smacking him in the face. So there you go, 3-0 down. You know, City rested Gundogan, Jesus, Sterling. They subbed three of their back four. Pretty useful ahead of like a busy period. They were able
look
to
at their bench compared to United's.
They were able to bring on Cancelo, give debuts to Angelino and Eric Garcia, one of these young centre-backs. Day after the game, by the way, Bernardo Silva posted a tweet comparing a picture of the young Benjamin Mendy to the logo of a Spanish chocolate peanut brand called Conguitos, which has been criticised as being that of a racist caricature. He later deleted the tweet, posted one saying, "You can't even joke with a friend these days." The FA are looking into it, according to Jacob Steinberg. Man City go to Preston in the Carabao, caught up with a rugby score, I guess. I don't know, maybe Phil Foden will get some minutes. Watford host Swansea. That'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the chaotic Emirates. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. First of all, thanks to everyone who came to Leeds on Friday night. We had fun, didn't we, Barry?
Yes, we did. Great fun.
That was lovely. Right, so more live shows. We're going back to Leeds, by the way, if you missed that one, the 20th of December. No Barry, me, Lars, plus two at the same venue. Come along. Although Barry doesn't want anyone to go to that
No, I'm happy enough for okay, people to go. Good.
October the 30th, me, you, Barry, Barney, Ronay, one more, plus some sciencey guests as Football Weekly takes on science, where we will definitely be humiliated.
That could be like Manchester City against your team. Polly Fours.
January the 27th at Liberty Hall in Dublin. Me and you, Baz, plus two to be decided. We'll tweet all the details about tickets. Come along, please. Right, to the Emirates then. Arsenal 3, Aston Villa 2. Nick, you were there.
I was.
That was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've covered Arsenal's last three games, the Watford, Frankfurt, and now this, and my head is still spinning. they are a bizarre team. The midfield are often like holograms. It's absolute end-to-end chaos. But they somehow got through it yesterday. And I mean, first of all, like, I've seen a lot of post-mortems of what happened on Twitter and below the line in my match report and stuff like that. I'd say that as a football fan, these are presumably the days that you have to enjoy when they come. Coming back from a goal down twice to win.
With 10 men.
With 10 men. And, you know, enjoy that. Also enjoy the fact that you're above Spurs, you're above Manchester United, and you're probably the least crisis-y at the moment of the crisis-y top clubs. But what is happening there? They can't keep playing in such a way that they're having to grab games out of the fire in such an unstructured, haphazard, chaotic way. They cannot keep playing like they did yesterday. That first half was one of the worst first halves I think I've seen from an Arsenal side
you
in
say they can't, but the last decade begs to differ.
what I don't understand is Unai Emery, who I think there's a big sort of existential question at the moment about what is he? Is he a project manager? Is he a quite conservative manager? Is he a reactive manager, proactive? And no one quite knows. He spent a lot of last season talking about control and how they had to have better control of games. They have absolutely none. And as I said, the midfield yesterday in the first half may as well not have existed. A particular culprit in that was actually Matteo Guendouzi, who let John McGinn run off him for the first goal for Aston Villa. In the second half, completely different. Guendouzi was absolutely fantastic. He took that ball. He drove them almost single-handedly at times. He was a force of nature. He had the fire in his eyes. You know, the fantastic run that created the penalty that Nicolas Pepe put away. Hit the post from 25 yards, clipped in the ball from which Callum Chambers was the surprise second goal scorer. And from his point of view, he seems like the sort of player who needs to be on a bit of a mission, a bit of a redemptive project, a bit of a sort of angry mood to drive himself on. And Arsenal are a bit like that. It's almost like they have to set themselves some sort of almost unsolvable problem to chase after. And when things are a bit, you know, more level, when the intensity is down in the first half of a game or something like that, they are very, very sluggish, shapeless, difficult to watch.
So all in all, they'll be the most fun team to watch this season, Nicky.
Well, my brother, who was at the game, said he enjoyed it more than he expected to, which is interesting because that's not even like an expected to after the sending off, after a goal down, just in general. I think as a sort of proposition for someone who doesn't have an investment in either team, they're probably a tremendous amount of fun to watch because, yes, you don't know what's coming. I think Nick has analysed it really perfectly on all fronts because it's almost predictably unpredictable if you want to put it that way. It's you know that Arsenal that aren't going to be able to control a game. I think Guendouzi is this sort of fascinating case study in Arsenal identity because he is exactly as Nick said. I think that there was so much praise going for him on Twitter yesterday, celebrating how well he'd played. And then you think, but in the first half he was sort of directly at fault, like he was directly to blame. And the first half, almost there was an image of it. It was, again, I'm obviously just caught up in people's expressions today, but his facial expression when things are going wrong, like this image of him on TV looking distraught.
Looks like he's on the verge of tears, doesn't he?
He looks so sad when Villa scored their second goal. Like, so sad.
And then he does. He takes the team on his back and turns things around. I think we have to say here, Villa were definitely complicit in this as well. I think that the run into the area that earns the penalty, everyone is so slow to react to him. And then Engels just sort of lumbers into him.
What is Engels doing there? It's madness. And what is Tyrone Mings doing at 2-1 up? You know, you're back 2-1 up. And then it's interesting because players don't like to just boot the ball out of play, right? Because you want to keep possession. But sometimes you should just boot the ball out of play and be confident enough in your defence. You go, right, now they've got a corner, but it's okay because we can reset.
I'd already written some lines for my match report at that point about how Mings is just looking like an absolute Rolls Royce of a footballer, which I think he has all season, and I still don't actually think there have been any or many better centre-backs than him in the last month and a half. But everything had been in perfect functioning order with him: distribution, communication, pace, power, strength. And he does that almost in the way of a player for whom so much was coming off and going right, that, okay, I will cushion it down for Neil Taylor, who didn't react that well either.
No.
And it will come off, but it was such a sloppy moment. And I have to say, Callum Chambers, who came on at half-time after Ainsley Maitland-Niles was sent off, finished that superbly. Like he jabbed it in like a, as you might expect Aubameyang to, or something like that. It's not something you would associate with him. But I think, as much as Arsenal, as we've said, have the fire in their bellies, Villa should have managed that game much better. They also, I think, Villa started the second half quite well. They had a couple of half chances, but it was just a couple of minutes before that first Arsenal goal where they started hacking at a few clearances and you thought, hang on a moment. And they basically stopped playing after that.
Well, it's the second week in a row where they've got worse when the opposition have had a man sent up. Like, sort of almost at that moment, you know, I don't know if that's the way to beat them, is to just get a man sent off. Before they were 2-1 up, they had 11 shots to Arsenal 7. In the final half hour, Arsenal outshot them 14-3. What is that? Too much respect or just naturally getting deeper?
I don't know. I think if I was a Villa player, I'd be scratching my head this morning and go, how the hell did we not only lose that game but not win it? Maybe it's just naivety. You could say Arsenal are more streetwise than, but are they? I don't know. I mean, the last three Arsenal games I've seen have been utterly, you used the word chaotic earlier, and it is chaotic, but Villa are entitled to feel hard done by, because we talked about the VAR decisions, about, you know, millimetre, infinitesimal distances for offside decisions. Then a blatantly obvious Socrates handball is not overturned by this technology we have to right these injustices. And it was crazy.
Do you think it would have been blatantly obvious in the days before VAR, when like every, because now everything's handball, or at least until recently it was. And this was, I think, a bit of a handball. I saw on Match of the Day 2, they were talking about how he moved his arm out towards the ball, which I don't think he did do.
Well, I think he had his arm out and he moved himself towards the ball.
I just think that in the pre-VAR era, we don't talk about that as much as we are talking about it now, which sounds a bit perverse, you know.
No, to your point. Lovely free kick from Aubameyang. Should Tom Heaton have done better with that?
I think it's a little bit of the same situation we talked about with Chelsea before, where you know you're too close to the goal to get that up and over, and it felt like the wall left a significant gap for him. Now, in which case, I guess, yes, it's Heaton's responsibility to make sure that one area is covered. Just quickly to wind back from that, Aubameyang, you would have normally expected to take the penalty 1-0 down. I thought that was an interesting moment, which feels like one of those moments that, because Pepe scored it, gets to be a look at the unselfishness, look at the wisdom of giving the new guy a chance to score. But it feels like that could easily have been a very Arsenal moment as well, because it wasn't even a great penalty. It was just straight down the middle, and it felt like if that gets saved, it's another very sort of lack of leadership, not taking responsibility, giving it, yeah.
It was quite surprising at the time, because Pepe, who I'm sure will come good, looked very much like a player who was burdened by both £72 million price tag and by needing a goal. So, I mean, I think I saw he scored something like 9 out of 10 penalties for Lille, so he can do it. But you're right, it was a big, big moment that could have backfired.
It's a big gamble, 1-0 down with a player gone.
Especially had Tom Heaton just stood still and just caught it.
And just saved it. But on Aubameyang, though, what a player, and what an impact he has had in, sort of, I don't want to say single-handedly, but in pulling these Arsenal results out of a fire for them. And he's they're very short of players. I mean, we've used the Guendouzi example, but they're very short of players who can do it over 90 minutes and perform. But he does it every single week. He even was given 90 minutes in Frankfurt the other day when ideally they'd probably have given him a rest, and he still scored. And he does it with a smile on his face as well. He's such a joyful player to watch. And I don't really see a better striker around than him at the moment.
Oh, see, because I think that Lacazette is a better player than Aubameyang. But Aubameyang's goals, like, I mean, the joy, absolutely, I agree with you. And I think the two of them together share that. But I think we can overanalyze football sometimes and just forget how important goals are. And it's what you talked about with Lukaku earlier at United. Whether or not you like Lukaku as a player, he scored pretty consistently, actually. He's been all the time in England. He was well into double figures. He's doing it already for Inter. And yes, Aubameyang, it's like you can count on him to give you a good quota of that all the time. And I think that has been a huge impact. Because yes, I technically enjoy watching Lacazette more. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant footballer. But for simple end product, Aubameyang has just been the most consistent.
You mentioned that game in Frankfurt. Arsenal won 3-0 on Thursday night. Played pretty well, although the scoreline might have flattered them a bit. Frankfurt had a man sent off in the 78th minute. Score was just 1-0 and had the better of it in terms of chances. Emiliano Martinez in the Arsenal goal had a very good game, made 7 saves. Great debut from Bukayo Saka as well for Arsenal. They play Nottingham Forest in the Carabao. Villa go to Brighton. Everton 0, Sheffield United 2. One shot on target for Sheffield United, a 2-0 win. Barry, that's how to do it, isn't it?
Yeah. Chris Wilder was, while delighted, made the point after the game that he thought it was the worst Sheffield United had played all season, and they still got the 2-0 win. I wouldn't agree with him. I thought they were excellent. They worked really, really hard. I thought they were well worth the win. I wasn't hugely surprised that they won the game either, because I was fairly confident they would do a number on Everton, and so it came to pass. But they're doing exceptionally well in this division, and Chris Wilder seems like a really canny manager who one suspects if he was in charge of Villa, and I don't mean this to disparage Dean Smith in any way, Villa would not have lost that game against Arsenal. But yeah, hats off to Sheffield United.
Do you think if he was called Crisio Wilderio, he'd be mentioned for top six clubs?
No, maybe not yet, but possibly in time if he changes his name to Crisio Wilderini.
Ahmed says, with Everton and Watford's poor performances, when do Everton hire Javi Gracia in place of the sacked Marco Silva, and when do Watford hire Marco Silva in place of the sacked Kike Sanchez Flores? Silva said, it was a tough game for us. Of course, we didn't deserve the result. But when you make mistakes like we did this afternoon, you don't get what you deserve. I mean, Everton are just so perennially frustrating, aren't they? It must be... I don't know who the worst team to support is in the Premier League, but I wonder if supporting Everton is there, because you get a tiny bit of hope and then just flattened.
It's one step forward, two back. And I mean, they played quite well the last time I saw them, which was against Wolves at home a couple of weeks ago. And Marco Silva's a funny one, isn't he? He came in to British football with such a positive press almost instantly for improving Hull, and I kind of felt it was a bit much, to be honest. Even though Hull were better under him, started okay at Watford and then obviously ended up leaving. I still don't think we know if he's any good or not, and I think Everton supporters, who I know lament quite frequently the organisation at the back for the lack of it at set pieces especially, I think going forward they're not as bad, but still haven't seen the evidence he can structure a top Premier League team. How long can the jury stay out for on Marco Silva?
Nicky, what have you made of Moise Keane's start at Everton?
He hasn't obviously torn up any trees just yet. I think there's plenty of scope to give him patience and time to do that. I thought there was definitely one chance to remember exactly where it was in this game, which he snatched at, which he did a little bit at Juventus as well sometimes. He hasn't had, certainly in this game, he wasn't getting the sort of space that I think he got sometimes at Juventus. What Juventus allowed him sometimes was real room to run into, which hasn't quite happened for him in the same way at Everton yet. But I'm not... I'm not worried for him just yet. I think there's plenty of time, and I think he remains everything that he was when he arrived, which is a very talented young player.
I don't think you can fault his enthusiasm, but he's not been given much to work with. You know, there is a lack of creativity there going forward.
There shouldn't be, should there?
If you look, there shouldn't, but there is. You know, Richarlison was almost playing as a full back at one stage, you know, like in that game, and you're kind of going, well, yeah, that's not really right, is it?
Everton complete the Sheffield combo when they go to Sheffield Wednesday on Tuesday night. Sheffield United host Sunderland the following night, both in the Carabao. To Turf Moor, two goals for Chris Woods, gave them a 2-0 win over Norwich. Back down to earth for Norwich. Burnley are up to ninth. Sort of perhaps proving that the Europa League is bad for teams by doing much better this season. Chris Wood's goalscoring record is inconsistent, but that second finish was lovely, wasn't it, from him?
Yeah, I think he left... I think it was Ben Godfrey, the Norwich defender, was maybe a bit flat-footed with the ball coming over, so he had a bit of time. But yeah, fantastic flashed instinctive finish at the near post, wasn't it? And I think... Burnley tore into Norwich in that first sort of 10-20 minutes with a real intensity and high press that we don't quite always get from them. And to be fair, like every season, I think this is going to be the moment they go beyond their sort of elastic limit and can't get it back and go down. And I'm proved wrong. Like I think what Sean Dyche did last season, when everything seemed to have completely gone awry and they'd lost that strength and pace and intensity they had before, to get that back is almost harder than building it in the first place, if you know what I mean.
So
doing that in the back end of last season and then taking it into this, I mean, whatever you think of their style or anything like that, I think he's done an absolutely miraculous job.
I'd love to watch Barnes and Wood up front every week. It's just fun, isn't it? Ashley Barnes, one of my favourites. Norwich had 59% of the ball away from home. They probably won't have much that season, but you get the impression that maybe they are better when teams really try and play out from the back and they can press them. Burnley and Norwich were both knocked out in the first round of the Carabao Cup. Friday night was Southampton 1, Bournemouth 3. Bournemouth up to 6th with this win. They had 35% possession, just 6 shots all game, compared to Southampton's 25. Højbjerg completed more passes than Bournemouth's entire midfield. So was this? What was this? Did Southampton deserve this, or?
It's interesting how Bournemouth have evolved, I think, and I think we were saying that a bit last season too. So apologies if I'm repeating a point, but when they came up, they were all about possession, pass, 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 pass. They were like that in the Championship. They were like in the first couple of seasons, I think, after coming up, and now Eddie Howe has turned them into a team that can absorb, can take that pressure and then attack really fast down the wings and through the middle. You've got such pace with like Fraser, King, Wilson, and I think their evolution into a team that can, you know, operate in that way is quite interesting.
The third goal was fun, Barry, wasn't it? Bednarek and Gunn just sort of running into each other,
comedy mix-up. Yeah, I mean, it was embarrassing, but it was so late in the game it didn't really make much difference. I imagine Ralph Hasenhüttl, he strikes me as the kind of guy who you don't want to make mad.
Do you reckon because he's quite jovial most of the time, but you think
I suspect behind that closed dressing room door after a bad performance, it's all hell could break loose.
I mean, the verb to Hasenhüttl someone does sound quite violent, doesn't it? Slightly choky, I imagine.
Hasenhüttl had moved to within an inch of his life. He was screaming for mercy.
Southampton go from one South Coast derby to another. They go away to Portsmouth.
So can I just interject briefly here?
Please do.
I find it quite fascinating that we've pored over the excruciating minutiae of the two VAR offsides, the big VAR offsides of the weekend. But the three biggest VAR injustices, you weren't going to mention the one in the Arsenal game, you haven't mentioned the one in this one, and you didn't mention the one in the Burnley-Norwich game. Three, I think, absolutely clear penalty decisions, none of which were overturned, despite being clear and obvious errors, in my opinion.
Please accept my apologies to begin with.
No, I'm not having a go at you specifically. I just think it's an interesting approach.
Yeah, no, you're right. The clear and obvious thing is hilarious. I mean, I just find it hilarious. You're talking about, you know, swearing.
I don't want to talk about every VAR decision, but yeah, I just thought it was curious.
I am waiting. Everyone, I think we're all waiting to find out where the bar is for clear and obvious, because we haven't had it yet. And we're so excited to find out I really just want someone to punch someone in the face and VAR go, I've checked it, it's totally fine. It's not a problem. I presume you're talking about Suarez kicking over Josh King, which to me looked like an absolute blatant penalty.
Yeah, and in the Southampton Bournemouth, or sorry, the other one, Cedric on Josh King and Ben Godfrey tripping Ashley Barnes. No pen given.
No pen. Crystal Palace 1, Wolves 1, OG from Dendonka in the first minute of the second half. Then in the last, Joel Ward, who'd taken the shot that Dendonka's own goal came from, missed his clearing header on the edge of the six-yard box, and Diego Jota got the equaliser. Wolves lost to Braga on Thursday night in the Europa League, and we've spoken how, you know, the Europa League doesn't help, same with Burnley. Do you think teams like this, I was talking to a Wolves fan on Saturday night about this, should take almost a two-season approach, right? So one season, you're not in Europe, you go and you try and get in Europe. Then you throw everything into Europe, as long as you stay in the Premier League, and you go, look, we'll take 15th and we'll give it a really good go because a European adventure is fun. And then the next year, we won't be in Europe and we can go again. So rather than taking it season by season, you take a two-year approach. Is that ludicrous?
Well, maybe that's what they're doing.
Well, it might be.
I think from a fan's perspective, it makes sense. I think most fans of clubs that are not habitually every year in Europe, when the opportunity arises, want to embrace it as much as they can. And given what Nick's already said earlier in the show about how the finances of the Premier League have shifted and the teams below the top four are all getting closer, the competition that you have to be able to sustain, the level you have to be able to sustain in the league to stay in that part of the table is really, really high. So I personally think, yeah, why not embrace the Europa League as long as you're not putting something serious like survival at risk?
Yeah, enjoy it. They celebrated qualifying for it. It crowned their achievement in finishing so high in the Premier League. So enjoy the ride.
And they've already had a great two-legged tie against Torino, which was really entertaining and took them to a not one of the biggest stadiums in Europe, but a really sort of passionate, noisy stadium that you get to have an experience in.
And I'd also add that Wolves could win that tournament, the Europa League. Like, I don't want to bring it back to Ipswich a second time today, but Ipswich are the good case study of a team that finished fifth in the Premier League in 2000-2001, went to the Europa League. Now I've got fantastic memories of the away trips in the UEFA Cup as it was, which I wouldn't swap, but I would swap the fact that we went down that year. I think there were other reasons for that. But Ipswich were never going to win the UEFA Cup that year. There were much, much better teams. I think Wolves, at their best with their first-choice team, could have a tilt at it. Why not? So go for it. It could be a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. Roman Sais, the only other player, aside from Maitland-Niles, to be sent off this weekend for a daft foul when he was on a yellow card. Nuno Espirito Santo said he doesn't have to apologise. He has to grow. Wolves have Reading in the Carabao. Palace were knocked out in the second round by Colchester. Newcastle 0, Brighton 0. Should we just celebrate the clearance off the line from Fabian Scher? The athleticism, the ability to do that is just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it was the only interesting thing that happened in the whole 90 minutes. So hats off to you, Fabian. It was wonderful. The only highlight of an incredibly dull game, and Newcastle's lowest attendance, I think, in 9 years.
Which you can understand for a team that's getting, what, 29% possession at home?
Yeah, but I think the official attendance was considerably higher than the actual attendance, massaged by the season ticket holders who weren't actually there, but they're not happy.
Brighton play Villa in the Carabao Cup. Newcastle get a full week's break, knocked up by Leicester in the second round. In the Football League, in the Championship, the top two both drew. Leaders Leeds conceded a last-minute equaliser at home to Derby. Swansea goalless at Bristol City. Preston, QPR and Forest all won and climbed to third, fourth and fifth, respectively. On Sunday, bottom side Huddersfield were 2-1 up at West Brom. Then they let in three in the last 20 minutes. 1 point from eight games for Huddersfield. Stoke got their second point of the season. Creditable goalless draw at Brentford. Ipswich, you're top of League One, Nick. How do you feel? I mean, we can bring it back to Ipswich again. Why not? How are you feeling?
Loving it. No, it's. I mean, I kind of want to get this season over and done with and just get back up, which I don't take for granted. But I think it's the kind of thing where if Ipswich don't get back up this season, they're in serious long-term trouble. But at the moment, like, you know, Paul Lambert has come in and done a lot to get the fans back on side. They're getting crowds of almost 20,000 at home. I went last Tuesday to watch them at MK Dons and was part of a crowd of 3,300 away fans, and it's not an easy journey from Ipswich in midweek or anything like that. So there is a bit of a positive vibe there now, quite unexpectedly. They're unbeaten. They've got a very strong squad for that level. Not playing that fluidly, but they've got players who can make a difference. So I'd be surprised, sticking my neck out, I'd be surprised if they didn't go back up. And then Barry can deal with the Twitter conversations after that.
And you've got a centre forward who made his wrestling debut in midweek.
James Norwood, yeah. He picked up a bit of a groin injury in that game at MK. So he said afterwards he had to temper down his original plan, which was to sort of, I mean, I'm not a wrestling expert, but to get quite active in the ring. But in the end, he did, what do you call it?
He did some body slams.
One throw, he called it, I think, or something like that. And I mean, it looked good. And I think he's got plans to do some more when he's not carrying a niggle.
Yes. I mean, you would have thought that would be in the contract. I mean, you're not allowed to go skiing, but you are allowed to wrestle the day after you went off with an injury and 3 days before another game.
Yeah, the thing that I saw him do made me think that's still a bit much. You know, we need you fit. You're pretty good. But he got through it.
Big winners of the day. Oxford United put six past Lincoln at Sinsel Bank, while their new manager, Michael Appleton, looked on. Poor old Bolton were moments away from their first win of the season until they conceded an injury time penalty to your boys Sunderland. Bowers, Aidan McGeady made no mistake. They're on minus 9 points. Another one-all draw for Sunderland.
Another one for the collection. I think the natives are getting restless on Wearside. Jack Ross may not be long for the Sunderland job because results aren't good enough.
Fair enough. Leaders Exeter in League Two were held to a draw by seventh place Newport. Crewe, Cheltenham and Swindon all closed the gap on the leaders. Swindon with a filthy 1-0 win at Cambridge, for whom the mighty Colin Calderwood has signed an 18-month extension. Bottom side Stevenage, the only side in League Two without a win, but they got a decent point at Forest Green. A depressing story from the conference. Dover won 2-0 at Hartlepool. In the aftermath of the first goal, Dover striker Ini Efiong, among a few other players, understood to have been racially abused from a small minority in the crowd. The confrontation caused an 11-minute delay in play, during which the two managers discussed taking their players off the pitch due to the alleged racist abuse. The players overruled them, wanted to stay on. Hartlepool's chief executive, Mark Maguire, said, "Hartlepool United utterly condemn racist behaviour of any description. We're proudly inclusive as a club. We know that the vast majority of Pool's fans will join us in standing up against words and actions which have no place in football or society." It was the Women's League Cup this weekend. Easy wins for last year's finalists Manchester City and Arsenal. Both won their ties 5-0. Reading beat Spurs 4-0. Birmingham edged it against Everton, winning 1-0 thanks to Rachel Williams' goal. Durham beat Villa 3-0. And Bristol City beat the London Bees 3-0. Among the other winners, Liverpool, one of the only WSL teams to lose to a lower league side. They went down 3-2 at home to Sheffield United. The WSL Cup starts with a group stage, so this one will go on for quite a while. Fitbar, Barry.
Yeah, not a huge amount to report, really. I suppose the big game of the weekend was the Edinburgh Derby between beleaguered Hibs and beleaguered Hearts. And
who was least beleaguered by the end?
By the end, Hearts were least beleaguered. Craig Levein masterminded a come-from-behind victory, and his side won by the odd goal of three. And that leaves Hibs in 11th now. They've 1 point off the bottom of the table, and their manager, Paul Heckingbottom, had the air about him afterwards of a man who suspects the jig might be up as far as his tenure in charge is concerned. Craig Levein, probably this might buy him some time.
Did you see the policeman behind the goal for Hearts? Hearts scored and the policeman went out to celebrate and then realised he was in full police uniform.
Realised he was a policeman.
He was being a policeman at that exact moment and put his arms down.
And then elsewhere, sort of straightforward wins for Celtic, who came from behind to beat Kilmarnock 3-1, and Rangers cantered to victory over St Johnstone 4-0.
Thank you very much.
Celtic 3 points ahead at the top of the table.
Cheers, Bas. That'll do for part two. We'll begin part three with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
All right, thank you. I'm on a train.
In the quiet carriage?
Well, I'm not in a carriage at all now. I'm hanging around in the joiny bit between the carriages.
Okay, it's a bendy place, the joiny bit. I wish you the best of luck. Right, Barcelona lost 2-0 to Granada, who went top following the game, now in third, 5 places above Barca. What happened there?
Well, basically everything. And I don't know, that doesn't really help. They made a dreadful error in the first minute to concede the first goal. They made a dreadful error to give away the second from a penalty. But it was more that the whole thing was totally dysfunctional. Nothing worked. They only produced one shot on target all game, even with Messi and Ansu Fati coming on at half-time. And I think the worrying thing from Barcelona's point of view is that this doesn't feel like a one-off bad game, even though watching it, I think it genuinely might be the worst game I can remember. I'm really struggling to find a game quite as bad. And yet, in a way, the best response to that is to say that when I mentioned this on Twitter, loads of people came wading in with a whole load of other options. And so this tells you that this isn't in isolation. You know, this is a Barcelona team that haven't gone away from home since April last year, that are now down in 10th in the league. They were beaten by Athletic Bilbao. They drew at Osasuna. They're conceding goals. I think they've gone behind in 5 of the 6 league games this season. And they failed to score in 3 of them. They've got the worst defensive record in the division. And the whole thing is, it's just kind of crumbling. And of course, you can take some of this back to Anfield, but obviously what Anfield did as well was reveal some things that were below the surface, reveal some things that were there. Or maybe not so below the surface. A lot of people were critical even before Anfield. And that they didn't really deal with. And one of the options, of course, at that point was to change manager, was to shift things, was to try and change the mindset. But they lived in this kind of comfort that I think has been part of the reason why they're so bloody awful now.
Real Madrid won 1-0 at Sevilla, so their crisis is over, right? Hazard and Bale starting together in the league for the first time. How did it go?
Well, it went very well. This is the first time they've won at Sevilla in the league for 5 years. A really, really big result, and particularly the pressure they were under after Paris. And this is a different type of Real Madrid performance. You know, after Paris, Zidane complained about the lack of intensity, the lack of work, and this time they got a very good defensive performance from them. It wasn't a particularly great game, certainly not as good as these games tend to be. Both Bale and Hazard played really strong defensive roles, even though in theory, of course, they're the two wide men in a front three. And I think Zidane, after the game, was really pleased with that. I mean, I don't think this was a great performance by any means. I don't think this was a Real Madrid showing, right, we've got everything in place now. But it was showing to Zidane, at least, that they can do some of that work that he was accusing them of not doing. They can close some of the gaps through midfield, which, of course, has been such a big problem against Paris Saint-Germain. And, of course, it takes them top. So even if they haven't had a great start to the season, and the truth is they haven't, they're now in a very strong position. They've got a 4-point lead over Barcelona already.
Atletico, a goalless draw with them against Celta Vigo. 2 games without a goal now. Is there something wrong there?
I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong. I think, and obviously I blame myself in this as well, that after the first 3 games, which they won the ball, we probably allowed ourselves to think that it was slightly better than it really was. You know, they played sides that they really should have beaten and didn't always beat comfortably. Eibar, Getafe, Leganés. And I think in a way, this is kind of sort of what you expect, that some of the creativity is not always going to be there. Costa doesn't look quite right. João Félix has his moments, but not enough of them. They're relying really heavily on Trippier on one side and Lobby on the other. Two very different types of fullback. Trippier is all about the delivery. Lobby is much more about the speed and the aggressiveness and the willingness to run at people. But then it's just not quite happening for them. I suppose the good thing from their point of view is that this is a return to them keeping a clean sheet. Because I think I'm right in saying that they've conceded 2 goals in each of the previous 3 games. But I don't think they're concerned about it. But I think there is a sense of disappointment, because after the start that they had and having allowed themselves to get a 5-point lead over Barca and Real Madrid, they probably felt that they should be in a far better position now than they are.
And as we all thought at the start of the season, Athletic Bilbao, top of the league, conceded just once so far this season. Is this sustainable?
It's not sustainable. They won't stay there, but it is true that this is part of a much broader trend. It's not just these five games. When Garitano took over as manager last year, I think it was 12, maybe 13 weeks into the season, they were in genuine trouble of going down. They'd only won one game. They'd been completely disastrous. And he basically went back to, I suppose you'd call it back to Athletic basics. Very, very tough, very aggressive, defensively strong, playing quite long for the most part, using the speed of a Nepalese quickest player.
And the train took Sid away. Sid Lowe, hurtling towards Madrid on a train. Great nostalgia for those who were sad that we'd brought
him
a beautiful line for the last few weeks. A welcome back to the previous sounds of Sid Lowe. Sid, have we found you again?
I can hear you, but you probably can't hear me.
I can hear you. I was feeling, when I thought tremendously there, you were just rounding up your season about Athletic Bilbao. You can't hear a word I'm saying.
I might not hear you again.
I love you, Sid.
And you.
Cheers. Take care, Sid Lowe. In the interests of honesty and for the tape, let it be known that no one else reacted to Sid's terrible line on a train and my humorous filling, because they all left the studio because we recorded the Sid bit after everyone had gone because he was unavailable. Now back to the pod in real time, where I start talking about the Bundesliga. In Germany, RB Leipzig continue their good start to the season with a 3-0 win at Werder Bremen. Leipzig stay top, 2 points ahead of Bayern, who tonked Cologne 4-0. Philipp Coutinho scored his first goal for the club from the penalty spot. Dortmund a third. They slipped up again, went ahead twice, but pegged back by Eintracht Frankfurt both times. The final goal, an 88th minute own goal from Irishman Thomas Delaney. It ended 2-2 after the game. Marco Reus was asked whether there was a problem with Dortmund's mentality.
Is that Irishman Marco Reus?
Irishman Marco Reus as well. To which he replied, "I'm so sick of you guys with your mentality bullshit." So I'm guessing that's a no then. Schalke won their third game in a row to go fifth. Hertha picked up their first win of the season over bottom-placed Paderborn, who are now the only team in the Bundesliga without a win so far. Italy, Nicky Bandini, the Milan derby.
Yes, a slightly, underwhelming derby itself, I thought. Inter totally in control for most of it, even though they didn't score until just after half time. Neither Inter or Milan look great at the moment, but Inter, this was their fourth win out of four, they're top of the table. They are doing what you almost expect an Antonio Conte team to do, including being colossally underwhelming in Europe. But yes, you sort of have two teams that, again, despite neither of them quite being on fire, just feel like they're on very different trajectories at the moment. Both got new managers in the summer. Conte has maybe not instilled sparkling football yet, but he's got these two young, dynamic midfielders, Nicolò Barella and Stefano Sensi. The latter in particular has just blown me away in the first part of this season. I think he's been brilliant. But it was Barella who gave the cross for Lukaku to score the second goal. So Lukaku got his name on the score sheet, and it's 3-4 so far for him at Inter. So there's a sense of a team moving in the right direction. Milan, on the other hand, came into this game fine with 6 points from nine games, but I think they'd had maybe four or five shots on target across their first three games in total. They were supposed to have a sort of injection of something new this season themselves. Again, new manager Marco Giampaolo has come in with his reputation for being a great attacking coach. He's the guy who got Fabio Quagliarella at 36 to be the top scorer in Serie A. Brilliantly, Quagliarella last week came and gave an interview with DAZN in which he said that he had spoken to Giampaolo five or six times in 3 years, which is perhaps a little bit of a damning indictment of the manager who's supposed to have done so much for him. But yes, Giampaolo's come in and he's got, whilst they haven't spent like Inter spent, he's got still something like 70 million euros worth of new toys to play with there that were brought in since last season. Benacer and Krunic, these two creative midfielders from Empoli. Benacer was the player of the tournament at the Africa Cup of Nations. So these are good creative players, neither of whom are getting any time in the side at all. Neither of them in the team for this derby. He's got Theo Hernandez came in, who came off the bench finally in this one at least. Rafael Leao, who hadn't started a game up front, young Brazilian player who joined from Lille. He started up front, was probably the best player for Milan outfield, other than Donnarumma in this game. So he's got all these new toys and he's not using them. So you have a Milan team that looks exactly the same as it did last season under Gattuso. And everyone's wondering why on earth this new guy's been appointed just to use the same players and produce a rubbish performance in the derby. So yes, a good win for Inter, but lots of questions for Milan coming out of this one, I think.
First goal for Aaron Ramsey for Juve as Juventus come from behind.
Yes, a bit of a deflection on it, but nevertheless, good for him to get off the mark in his debut for Juventus. That was preceded in this game by an absolutely sort of bonkers goal for Verona. I think this is going to be one of my favourites of the whole season. So Verona, away at Juventus, heavy underdogs, as you'd expect, win a penalty early on, still 0-0. The penalty hits the post. You get a follow-up that also comes back off the woodwork. So they've had two bites at it. And the inevitable frustration that comes with missing your chance against Juventus. The ball gets half cleared and Miguel Veloso just takes it on the half volley and just wellies it into the top corner. An absolutely brilliant finish. So that was my personal highlight of that game, even though, of course, it didn't hold for the result. As you say, Ramsey got his first goal. Juventus, 10 points from four games, so not far off Inter at the top.
And Frank Ribery, he also got his first goal in Serie A 2, but Fiorentina still bottom.
Well, this was another sort of, because there were a few this weekend, a game with tremendous narrative to it. There was actually some racism stuff at this game that I want to get into in a second. But just on the football for a second, Fiorentina have not won a game in Serie A since February. They are on this huge run of not being able to win a game. They're 2-0 up away to Fiorentina, away to Atalanta, going a good team going into the latter stages. Atalanta pull one back. You get to injury time and Atalanta equalise only to have the goal disallowed for a VAR review. And it's one of those handballs where it's not even about his arm being outside his body, but if the ball strikes an attacker's hands rather than the defender in the belt to a goal, we automatically chalk it off. So we're like 3 minutes into injury time. Fiorentina, who haven't won since February, get this reprieve and then still manage to blow it in the remaining minute and a half of injury time. But the goal you're talking about was a cracking goal and a bit of a sort of ghosts of football future and football past coming together with Ribery at 36 years old being set up by Federico Chiesa, who's one of the sort of coming talents of Italian football. So very nice goal for him. This game, as I say, unfortunately, yet another to add on top of what we were just talking about. And of course, more cases in Italy in recent weeks. Racism story here. Dalbert, who joined Fiorentina from Inter this summer, racially abused I don't remember if it was in the first half or second half, doesn't matter, racially abused during this game, and the referee, Daniele Rossato, Dalbert said something to the referee. The referee followed the protocol, which is to suspend the game, and an announcement is made over the speaker saying, if this happens again, we're going to abandon the game, which obviously didn't happen. They completed the game, so in that sense, got the reaction that I suppose is desired and good to see people following the protocol and doing that. That said, a lot of comment in Italy about the fact that when that announcement went out over the speaker saying, look, if this keeps happening, the reaction of, because we're talking about a small number of people making the racist chants to begin with, the reaction of the whole stadium being then to whistle very loudly at the speaker announcement that the game could be abandoned. Now, of course, you can't interpret the reaction of every individual fan. Some might just be frustrated because they could be whistling at the people who've done it. But the image that has come out and that a lot of the people, a lot of the columnists in Italy have picked up on is this idea that actually, is this only a minority of people, or are we seeing that when people are confronted with stop racism or stop the football, actually they would rather that the football go on? Is I think how a lot of people in Italy, again, I'm not sort of even really giving this opinion myself as much as saying this is what's in the columns in Italy this morning. It's not a good look.
To Ligue 1 in France, PSG were bailed out by Neymar once more. He scored the only goal of the game in the 87th minute as they beat Lyon. They stay top 3 points ahead of Angers and Nice, who were the only other team in the top half to win this weekend. Strasbourg got their first win of the season against Nantes on Friday night, while Monaco are still waiting for theirs. They played out a goalless draw in Reims. Other bits of Europa League from last Thursday. Lorient Carrius had another mayor in Europe. I sort of feel that Karius, if he makes any mistake, it's just sort of highlighted a million times. Beşiktaş lost 4-2 to Slovan Bratislava. He came out for a missed header, 25 yards from goal, clattered into his own man, left the net unguarded for Bratislava's opener. F91 Dudelange of Luxembourg won their first ever European competition group stage match, winning 4-3 away at Apoel Nicosia. A Wolfsberger of the Austrian Bundesliga won at German Bundesliga side Borussia Mönchengladbach 4-0. You could have got 450-1 on that scoreline. Roma beat Istanbul Başakşehir 4-0. Lazio lost 2-1 at Cluj. How much stock do Italian sides place in the Europa League?
Different stocks for different clubs. I think Napoli last season were very much trying to win it until they ran into Arsenal. I think that those are, again, to follow the same lead as we discussed with Wolves, teams that could consider themselves capable of winning it if they applied themselves to it. I think Lazio will certainly be disappointed with that result. I think they have higher expectations than that.
Hey, Baz, it's the best FIFA Football Awards tonight in Milan. How are you feeling?
I'm beside myself with excitement.
I got confused when I saw this. I was like, didn't they do this a month ago? But that was the UEFA Player of the Year Awards. This is the fourth edition, everyone, of the best FIFA Football Awards, set up after FIFA ended their association with the Ballon d'Or.
Mm.
So is the Ballon d'Or to come? I mean, it all gets quite muddling. All the same people are up for everything. Van Dijk, Ronaldo and Messi up for the men's award. Lucy Bronze versus Megan Rapinoe and the evil tea drinking Alex Morgan for the women's one. They do the Puskas award, don't they? We watched the 10 from the long list. The short list is Messi's little chip for Barca against Real Betis. Juan Quintero scoring a free kick, which is marginally better than Aaron Cresswell's for River Plate against Racing Club. And Daniel Zuri, an overhead kick of Trevor Sinclair quality, I would say, Baz, for Debrecen versus Ferencvaros.
I wouldn't say it's of Trevor Sinclair quality.
Okay.
But it is a very good goal. It would be my pick of the three.
Mm. Were there any on the long list that you think?
It was quite funny because before we watched them, I said, is there like some clogger from the League of Ireland on the long list? And it turns out there kind of was. It was from Northern Ireland. what's her name?
Billy Simpson,
scoring from inside her own half with a very agricultural clearance / shot. I think Billy should have been on the shortlist.
Yeah,
it should have been Quagliarella. I can't believe that back heel. And he did two last season. He deserves to be in there just for repeat
consistency,
proving that it wasn't a fluke.
Yeah, you're right. That is a great goal as well, isn't it? Gavin Henson, formerly of the Welsh national rugby team, has been turning out for a Sunday league side set up last month called Super Fox United in St Brides, West Wales. He's opening a pub nearby and put a team together with some friends. They play in the Bridgend and District Sunday Football League First Division. They lost 8-2 at the weekend to Lichard Park, but Gavin Henson scored his first goal, a free kick he smacked off the underside of the bar. So well done to Gavin Henson.
I think what my main takeout from that story is Gavin Henson has opened his own pub. I cannot see that ending well.
Well, listen, that'll do for today. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nicky.
Thanks.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.